as Sophia reminded me, it's in appeared months ago now in the archive here, just as I left Santa Barbara. And I'll start with a brief introduction just to remind people of the issues of trying to describe the experience of an infalling observer from the point of view of the ADS-CFT correspondence. Just a very brief statement about I'll then spend some time talking about a certain class of black holes called, which I might call hyperbolic ADS black holes. These were written down by Roberto Emperon in 99. I'm going to talk about these. The basic question is, how do you see behind the black holes? These gave us a hint as how to do it. They're somewhat funny objects, and I don't think at the end of the day the lessons that I'll learn are specific to this. I think they can be generalized, but it was the answer sort of became a little more obvious to us from the study of this class. I'll then specialize to a particular class of N equals zero, a locally ADS black holes. It's a particular black hole of this class. And finally, I'll talk about space-time coordinate transformations in the dual quantum field theory, which is the heart of our results. Okay, so first, just by way of a brief introduction, let me write down the sort of typical Penrose diagram for an evaporating black hole. So I imagine, for example, that I form a black hole with some in-collapsing spherical shell, and a singularity forms and an event horizon forms. Now, if we believe that the formation and evaporation of black holes is unitary, for all intents and purposes, it appears that the black hole evaporates through Hawking radiation. This Hawking radiation looks extremely thermal, and all of the information about what makes up the black hole or things that fall in afterwards are going to be captured in very, very subtle, long-time correlations in the outgoing radiation, just as it would be very hard to see how a lump of coal is heated up through its radiation, even though that process should also be described by quantum mechanics, as we all believe. On the other hand, when you look at this black hole, if the black hole that you form is sufficiently large, much larger than the Planck scale, then the curvature near the horizon isn't particularly large. And an observer falling into the black hole will experience classical and semi-classical physics well into the interior of the black hole before it starts to reach the singularity. But that classical physics isn't well captured in the outgoing Hawking radiation. So a question would be, how do you recover this classical physics from the outgoing Hawking radiation? Or what's the transformation between these two ways of looking at the same quantum mechanical picture? Because everything going on here should be captured in the outgoing Hawking radiation if you believe the unitarity. Now, this issue is pointed up in particular when you think about black holes in the context of the ADS-CFT correspondence. So let's just talk about the most standard correspondence between five-dimensional anti-de Sitter space and some four-dimensional conformal field theory. In particular, if you look at UN super Yang Mills at finite temperature, this is a dual. This four-dimensional theory in this particular configuration is dual to ADS-5
Fortunately, black hole. With a Penrose diagram, which looks something like this. And a metric, which looks something like this. Where this omega 3 is the metric on the 3 sphere. And f of r is r squared over l squared plus 1 minus gm over r squared. Where script L here is the radius of curvature of the underlying anti-de Sitter space. And as R goes out to infinity, this goes as R squared minus dt squared plus d sigma 3 squared. This, the dual field theory lives on S3 times R, as you can see here. And I'm reviewing this in part because we're going to worry about a case in a little bit where I change the sign in front of the one here. But out at infinity, this is what you get. And the issue is here, the time which the field theory naturally sees is tied to time and Schwarzschild coordinates. And for example, from the point of view of Schwarzschild coordinates, here are my equal time slices. And this is t goes to infinity, so an infalling observer appears to take an infinite amount of time to reach the horizon due to blue shifting near the horizon. This is not totally insensible in the classical limit, which is to say in the n goes to infinity limit. This is just saying that as I start with some excitation, the excitation slowly spreads and just thermalizes. That this black hole represents some thermal configuration, and the infalling observer thermalizes with the thermal state that's already there. But the question you might ask then is the semi-classical physics behind the horizon when the black hole is more captured in the Gauge theory, as you would expect if this is a good dual, and how is it encoded? The other thing you might be able to say also something about the singularity. The singularity is the point where semi-classical physics breaks down even for an infalling observer. But you at least want to be able to say, as the observer falls in, that near the horizon things start classical and only break down in the singularity. So the hope is to get some handle on the singularity in the long run. Now, there has been some work on looking behind the horizon in the context of the eternal black hole by describing this thermal state by some thermal field bubble, looking at correlators in the two thermal field bubbles by Chasuguri and Schenker and various, and then Fitkowski and company, Hong Liu and Stucci and so forth. This is interesting, but it's hard from those results how to really see what an infalling observer is doing. So I want to take a different tack.
This black hole doesn't evaporate, right?
This particular black hole doesn't evaporate. So we'll actually talk about a case where we can describe the black holes which form and in fact evaporate at finite ends. Yes. Okay, so to set this problem up, I want to talk about a particular class of black holes, which I call hyperbolic ADS black holes.
Wait, he didn't say anything about the size of the mass. Why doesn't this evaporate? He didn't say it was a big black hole.
It's an eternal black hole. So I've got, it's basically when you write down these eternal black holes, you're sort of in equilibrium with your Hawking radiation.
Oh, okay. So you're assuming the mass is big enough.
But for a small black hole, if you form it from collapse, it will evaporate. But,
right.
But here I've sort of enforced that it's
okay.
It might, for a small black hole, it might fluctuate between that and pure ADS or something like that. But that's not important. That's a side matter for us. I'm going to talk about
small black hole.
I'm going to talk about a particular kind of black hole, which Amparan called topological black holes. Let me describe them first by their space-time solutions. They're almost the same as these black holes, except for this sign in front of the one. That doesn't matter out at an and I replace omega 3 by either hyperbolic free space or some compact orbital fold of hyperbolic free space. The out near infinity, things will look very similar except for the curvature of this direction. But as you go in, this, as r becomes of order l, the sign here starts to matter. Just here I have the same as here, but f of r is r squared over l squared minus 1 minus g m m over r squared. And furthermore, in this particular case, there's a whole interesting class of solutions as n goes negative. In fact, there's a somewhat rich phase structure of solutions in this particular case, so let me describe them. The first case is when g Newton m is less than what I'll call mu x, which is minus l squared over square root of 2. In this case, the solution, this is r goes to infinity. F dt squared plus the r squared over f plus r squared over l squared d sigma squared, where this is h3 possibly modded out by some infinite discrete group, which leaves you with a compact hyperbolic space. So I could either just look at h3 itself, or I could look at some negatively curved compact spaces. Many examples exist.
But there is a huge difference between those two cases, right? One's non-perturbatively stable, the other one's.
Yes, we'll talk about that. And in fact, we'll be talking about the case which is unstable. It's not the end of the world, but it makes life a little more complicated. So here, as r goes to infinity, I just get r times, and we call it sigma. Sigma, this is a naked singularity. And it's a particular, just as an aside, it's a bad naked singularity. It's one you wouldn't want to see in space-time because it looks very much like the kinds of naked singularities you get for negative match Schwarzschild black holes. And as Robin Gary Horowitz taught us years ago, pointed out years ago, these kinds of singularities should not be resolvable in the field theory or else spot space would be unstable because it would just produce negative match Schwarzschild black holes. So it's a somewhat a side issue for what I want to say today, but somehow this should get screened out. On the other hand, it's also true that indeed this theory is unstable. So. Okay. The next, at mu equals mu extremal, so mu here is what I call this g Newton m. When mu is equal to mu extremal, I get a Penrose diagram which looks like this. It's the it's the ADS version of extremal Reister-Nordström. At the horizon, the function f has a double zero. And locally, it looks like ADS 2 times S2 times 3. But anyway, it's an infinite distance away in R. And it looks, for all the world, like extremal Reister-Nordström. This is t goes to infinity. This is t goes to minus infinity. And so forth. And then if mu extremal, if mu is between mu extremal and zero, I get something which looks more like regular Reister-Nordström with an inner and outer horizon, like so. And then finally, for mu greater than or equal to zero, I get something which looks more or less like a standard Schwarzschild black hole with a space-like singularity. I'll talk about the mu equals zero case in a minute. When mu equals zero, the singularity is just an orbital singularity, and the solution is locally anti-considered space. And as soon as I raise mu, this becomes a standard black hole singularity. So all of these go as r goes to infinity, as r squared minus dt squared plus d sigma squared. So it is reasonable to suppose that These are all dual to quantum field theory on this space-time background, perhaps at finite temperature, to the degree that you can make sense of finite temperature, which we'll talk about in a minute. Yes, there would be solutions to the full ten-dimensional equations. I mean, these are solutions to Einstein's equations with a negative cosmological constant. So I can tensor it with S5, certainly. And as I'll show, you can actually get the mu equals zero black hole, certainly, as a normal folding of standard ABS. So I think everything else retains. I think if the statement is going to be these are dual to gauge theory on R times sigma. Gauge theory is a little exotic, but I think this is almost certainly true. Okay, so that's the story. Let me now turn around and talk a little bit about what this, what the dual gauge theory might look like. So the first interesting thing is that this describes that this is a system which has black holes, and in a dual gauge theory, it looks like you can actually describe the formation, and we'll say a little bit about it, and probably the evaporation of black holes as well. So let me talk a bit about gauge theory dynamics on R times sigma. Well, the basic issue that makes this a little complicated, but also I think interesting, is that when I look at the gauge theory, so I have an F squared, I'm just going to talk about the bosonic degrees of freedom for a second. I have the phi as an adjoint scalar field. Let me call it little phi, not to confuse it with corresponding Hausdorff multiplet. And then I'll have some trace. Phi, of course, lives in a 6 of the SO6R symmetry. I'm going to suppress. But then the important thing is there's an R trace phi squared term here. And when R is negative, then this last term gives you a negative mass squared for the scalar field. And so as phi goes out to infinity, it's going to look like the negative mass scalar field is an inverted harmonic oscillator potential. Now, it turns out that all nodes except if sigma is not compact, that term isn't really an issue because I can, the infinite volume allows me to lock phi down. But if sigma is compact, which is the case we're kind of interested in, all nodes except for the zero node and maybe a few kk modes, a small but finite number of kk modes, are unstable. In fact, the issue was studied by Spergel and Cornish for other reasons. I can certainly find compact hyperbolic manifolds for which only the zero mode is unstable. For generic compact hyperbolic manifolds, if you put the quantum ones, are unstable as well. They were interested in this when they were thinking about looking for signatures of periodicity in the spatial directions of the universe through the same. But there are certainly examples exist where only the phones are zero and stable, so we can just worry about that if you like.
So you mean stable, not unstable?
All nodes except for the zero mode are stable. Sorry. I don't think the few Kluze-Klein modes matter, but just to make my life easy, I'll just concentrate on the case where only the zero modes are a problem. Okay, so let me look at one of these zero modes, phi. The zero mode feels this inverted harmonic oscillator potential. I can imagine, for example, taking a particular eigenvalue of this adjoint scalar field well on the Coulomb edge, so this one's effective, and just studying its dynamics. Or I could take, for example, a configuration where I take all n eigenvalues out onto the Coulomb branch, smear out smear out the wave functions over the S5, and then I describe what's roughly speaking a shell of three brains smeared out over the S5 at a fixed value of the radial position here. So that phi is roughly m string squared times r. It's the position of the three brain in this background, the radial position of three brain in this background in string units. So we can so now we can actually study the formation of these black holes by imagine taking phi out, phi to be very large, and sending in, say, this spherical shell at some energy. And the energy in the field theory should match the mass in the space-time. And the claim is as follows. Here is my mu extremal. Let's take a spherical shell of n d3 brains. So I'm taking all of the d3 brains. I'm taking the theory entirely out of the Coulomb branch. I'm sending in the spherical shell. And I can ask, roughly speaking, what happens? Classically, you might expect that if I'm sending in a spherical shell at energies below zero, I will get a bouncing solution. So those shells will come in, bounce off the potential, and leave. Whereas, and these bouncing solutions will correspond to the Riesen-Rotstrom type black holes. Whereas if I send in a shell here, you might have expected the shell just sails on to the origin and run through. And these would correspond to the black holes with space-like singularities. Now, the story is more complicated, I'll talk in a minute, because as the shells get closer and closer, various other degrees of freedom, even the W bosons become lighter, and change the story substantially. But they'll change the story in an interesting way, and so there'll be a nice mapping between the behavior of the spherical shell and the gauge theory and the causal structure of the space-time.
Sorry, your n is not the same n as the n of these three brains that produced you.
Yeah, it is. So I'm taking the thing entirely. I'm imagining take the theory entirely out of the Coulomb branch.
Okay, so those are the n's. So you don't.
Yes.
But then you don't have a potential to start with, right?
No, I do. I still have this potential. I still have the first class of potential to start with this.
Wait,
this still matters.
Where does R come from?
R is the curvature of the. R here is the curvature of the four-dimensional space-time.
Oh, okay.
So because it's compact hyperbolic space.
So you are studying in the Hill theory,
right?
Or which collect. I mean, I guess my question is, when you are talking about collapsing these three brains, are you talking about collapsing?
No, I'm sorry. I'm talking about a collapsing black hole described by these three brains. My language. The three brains are just moving along. The Coulomb branch.
But it originally collapses in the Minkowski space-time, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, and so it is just the back reactions that will produce this
potential. The potential comes, we can talk about where the potential comes from if you look at the DBI actions of a single D3-brain probe in the space-time, for example. You will actually get that negative mass square term in the DBI action.
It's coupling the curvature.
Right.
Yeah.
It's coupling
the question is where, okay, so if those deep brains are very dispersed, right, so that your shell has very low density of these three brains,
mm-hmm.
The background is Minkowski space time. Right? I'm saying that this potential comes if you try to scatter or, you know, collapse these three brains in anti-de-Sitter space.
The potential comes from the particular background I'm talking about. If I take a single D3-brain probe, we'll see this potential.
Okay.
Well, let me talk about the DBI action, you'll see that. So I don't think it's a result of the collective effect of the D3 brains.
My question is very simple. So there is a... So in the ADS space, right, it's a dual geometry to SUM, right?
Right.
Is the N there the same N as UN there?
I could choose to do so, I could choose not to do so, I will choose to do so. For the formation of black holes, that's the situation I want to describe. I could also talk about a probe D3 brain where I just send in one here in a UN theory. But I'm going to choose to send in a spherical shell of MD.
Right, so the first I would understand,
right.
But... The other one when you say N and N.
Well, let me, no, so what I'm going to talk about is here's, so classically, well, so here I have some D3 grains, the spherical shell is falling in. I have something where out here, lambda is less than zero. In here, lambda is equal to zero, and it's an obligated spacetime, which you might describe. And the question is going to be, now, what happens? Does it bounce out? Does it fall in?
So the lambda equals zero region, is it just Minkowski space in strange coordinate?
Yeah, it's got this hyperbolic slicing. Yes, it's flat space. It's flat space.
Okay. Is the slicing a bit smooth? Is there not some kind of orbital folding there?
That's a good question. I think there certainly, if you tried to form the n equals zero black hole this way, I think you would see an orbital folding derivative inside as well. It's less than a lot of it. So we'll look locally in the house. Okay, so classically, you would, without including any quantum corrections, phi would be equal to phi 0 times cosh. For energies less than zero, and for energies, and it becomes cinch for energies greater than zero, and I get an exponential of energies precisely equal to zero. But quantum mechanically, it's going to be a lot more complicated because as the brains move in, I can start the mass of the W boson stretching between the brains is changing, and they can start to be excited. They can start contributing substantially as they run in loops, and you have to worry about how those effects change the dynamics. In fact, the first important thing happens is as the spring moves in, the W bosons become light enough that they can start contributing, the loops of them can start contributing substantially to the effect production. Let's talk about that first. More generally, I'll just mention in passing, I can get quantum corrections to this simple Gauss picture from a wide variety of phenomena, from, as I said, integrating out what I will prosaically call W bosons. What I mean by those really are all the off-diagonal, all the terms which are off-diagonal in the UN, if I think of these as adjoint matrices, the off-diagonal components, which are becoming light as phi gets, as the diagonal components get small. And so that includes both the actual W bosons, the off-diagonal components of the adjoint scalar field, and so forth. I can also produce W bosons, I'll mention in passing, because their mass is changing as phi changes, you expect them to be produced. You might expect them to be produced just as I get I can get excitations in any time-dependent background. Finally, I can get things like Kaluza Klein modes on sigma. Also, if sigma is a compact hyperbolic space, which I get by an orbital fold, there's a rich spectrum of discrete Wilson lines. Sigma doesn't have to have homology, but it will have homotopy. So you can get, may or may not have homology, it will have homotopy. You'll certainly get this.
So, here, are you considering the motion of a single D brain? Is many D brains sitting at the origin of the plume?
You can talk about either. In either case, these will matter.
But okay. But if you have many D brains on top of each other, then W bosons are masses.
Well, I get a spherical shell moving in, so the W bosons will stretch between the brains on the S5. As I imagine it's disturbing. So what I'm going to do now is get a handle on when these are, I'm going to cheat a little bit just to get a handle on when these effects are important. Let me just look at a single probe D3 ray. And I think that all that is doing is sort of telling you when do I have to start worrying about the physics of these. I think it will extend to the spherical shell.
But for the spherical shell, I mean, if I have a single probe, there's a characteristic distance from the distance from the probe to everything else. But
yeah.
If you have a shell.
It's this characteristic distance would roughly be the radius of the S5 divided by S.
Well, that's a scale that characterizes the system, but if, there will be W bosons that are light all the time, right? Because they're always nearest neighbors on the shell. So it becomes a more complicated question. You know,
it becomes a more complicated.
Light W bosons, but not a lot. Is that important or not? I don't know.
I think the mass of the W bosons changes with the radius of the shell.
It certainly, I mean, the density is changing, so those distances are small.
Right. Yeah.
It's getting even smaller.
Yeah.
Redshifting would only make the mass even lighter.
Right. Yeah, that's what I mean. So it's
so you have many different kinds of W bosons, right? So you have a spherical distribution of eigen values.
Right.
Okay. So W bosons,
right.
So some are light, some are heavy.
Right.
All along, their masses are changing.
Their masses are changing. All I really want to get is a handle on sort of. I don't have any precise picture of what the effects are. I just want to get a handle on when do they start to become important. I'm going to cheat a bit just by looking at the action of a single grain probe. So if for a single D3 grain probe, just get an analogy with say the standard ADS case. If I go out on the Coulomb branch, far out on the Coulomb branch, the position of a single D3 grain probe is just described by a quadratic action, which is just the kinetic energy of the probe. Yes, of some volume. As the probe comes in, I start integrating out the W bosons, I get a more complicated effect of action for the probe, which is described by the Dirac-Bourne infill action in ADS space. And so the claim is the same here. So if I look at, and those higher derivative corrections come from loop effects. And so if we look at the DBI action, we can get some estimate of when the loop effects start to become important. It's very crude, but I think that's a good picture. So if I look at the single D3 grain probe, I find that the action, this is the volume of the compact hyperbolic space in string string units, and this is G string alpha prime squared dt minus r cubed root f of r minus r dot squared over f of r, and then there's a plus r to the fourth minus r horizon to the fourth. R horizon is where f of r disappears over L here. This comes from the Riemann-Riemann four-form potential. One thing to notice first is that at large r, L, the Lagrangian is just proportional to 1/2 r, f goes as r squared at large r. And if you look closely, the Lagrangian looks like this, and this sign is important. Indeed, the brain sees this negative harmonic inverted harmonic oscillator potential as expected from the field theory, which just comes out of the DBI action. But now as r gets small, the higher derivative terms here start to become important. And one of the effects of this now f of r goes to 0 as r goes to rh. That means the higher derivative terms are going to start to matter as the rate approaches the putative horizon. R dot has to remain less than f. This is sometimes called the scalar speed limit. You can deduce this just from causality of brain motion in the spacetime, but it's reflected in the effect of action, roughly speaking, through the square root. And that means that, in particular, because r dot has to be less than f, f goes to 0 as r goes to r, the horizon, you can deduce that the probe takes, indeed, an infinite amount of time to reach the horizon. Furthermore, if I expand s in small fluctuations, that is, I say I let r go to some classical r plus delta r. And if I expand in delta r, I'll find that l will go, roughly speaking, someone in delta r dot the 2n over f of r to the 2n minus 1. And you can show them that even if I cannot, if I change the normalization of delta r so that the quadratic term is canonically normalized, all the higher order terms will get, the coefficients will get larger and larger. So this effective action breaks down badly the horizon. More generally, you can estimate that loops are important if lambda phi dot over phi squared is of order 1. If it's much, as phi is very, very large, things are massive, the loops are important. But as you're moving in, the loops start to become important when this is true. And so you can ask, for example, in this diagram, so you can ask what happens in this particular diagram, just sort of a self-consistent, say, when is, we can ask, for example, when is this kind of solution, roughly speaking, self-consistent? So I just plug this into the action, and I plug these solutions into the action, and I ask, when does this become true? And it's interesting.
So, by the way, so you're talking about loops, but so you already know the form of the DBI action, and you are interpreting it as action obtained by integrating on
the W. And that certainly seems to be true for the
I believe it's true.
Right.
So, but nobody really computed.
People have checked to only as to one and certainly to one loop order for ADS and Minkowski spaces at finite temperature. So one and later on Kuritsos studied this. Studied this for phosphorus. I don't actually believe that doing loop computations in this theory is technically annoying because of the fact that it evolves it. So we haven't done it absolutely. We're just taking the not for granted, but it should work. And I should also say, even when it's strongly coupled, as long as you're far enough out on the Coulomb branch, it should work, roughly speaking, because the loops will go as a factor of lambda, but it'll be a factor of the W mass squared down starts from the propagator. Mm-hmm. So as long as you're far out of the Coulomb branch, the W mass is large, you have sort of an effective loop counting parameter for the off diagonal W bosons between the probe and everything else. And at least those loops should be suppressed far out of the Coulomb branch, and then you can match the supergravity cage theory. And that's what one, off to some field redefinitions, that's what one means. Okay, so just a word about this. When mu is less than mu extremal, then the loops are never important. So when mu is less than mu extremal, in fact, this shell bounces well before it ever gets to the origin, so I get something like this. And I don't really know what goes on internally, but here there's some one's guess would be, since inside here you expect the cosmological constant to be zero, that you're screened out the naked singularity here to some sort of enhanced on like that. That's all I'll say about it. We have the subdivision in good detail. But as soon as mu becomes greater than mu extremal, then the brain, the W bosons start to kick in, and you expect that the brains will start to slow down. For you, when I go to when I go above energies equals zero, the brains will come in and start exciting W bosons copiously, and this will trap the brains, in all probability trap the brains near the origin, because it will, for the brains to start separating, and the W bosons will get heavy, and it would cost energy until the W bosons annihilate. There should be some sort of trapping for these other brands as I go far larger, as I look at energies larger than zero, where the dual spacetime looks like one of these two standard torsional white particles. So this is nice, sort of, the gauge theory seems to have some hints of the phase structure that you see in the supergravity solutions, which is interesting. I want to say one other thing about the origin of field space. If I ignore quantum corrections for the sake of time here, this is just, I just want to make a very crude claim that there should be some relation between the origin of field space and singularity. I'll make the first half of that statement now just by mentioning that at the origin of field space, you only reach them when the energy is greater than zero. And furthermore, in this case, the W mass divided by, say, the mass of the KK modes, this is a nice dimensionless number, goes to zero, or at least gets small for W bosons. Say, so there's some, what I want to argue later is that there's, you can also kind of, when there's another frame where you can see into the singularity more naturally, where that ratio goes to zero when you reach the singularity. So there should be some relation between the origin of field space and the singularity. Okay, so now I want to concentrate on a particular version on the zero mass black hole. And again, it's here from which we'll get some hints about how to see behind the horizon, although I think in the long run, like I said before, that question should generalize. But tiny minds. So let me just look at an orbifold of analytic superspace. First, let's start with Poincaré coordinates. Rp squared over L squared minus t theta squared plus t x3 squared plus L squared over Rp squared Rp squared. So this is the metric of ADS5 in Poincaré coordinates. Here, here are the slices of constant data, and here are the slices of constant RP. Now, the first thing I'm going to do is write down, you can, this is just R4, and it's dual to a UN on R3 times R, or R4. But now I want to write down I'm going to take the same spacetime, but I'm going to slice the Minkowski directions differently. So I'll choose hyperbolic slicing, which is to say I'll replace minus dt t squared, minus d eta squared plus dx squared will be replaced by minus dt p squared plus dp squared d sigma h3 squared. So if I look, this is the Penrose diagram from Minkowski space, and these coordinates cover the forward light cone of a point. It doesn't matter which point. Here. And these are slices of constant tp. So it looks like a cosmological spacetime. It is just Minkowski space. The singularity as tp goes to zero is just a coordinate singularity. And if I look at here is the Penrose diagram of ADS and Poincaré coordinates, and if I look at ds5 squared is minus rp squared over l squared minus dtp squared plus dp squared d sigma squared plus l squared p squared. These will cover, for example, this piece of Poincaré coordinates where this corresponds to tp goes to 0. Actually, greater than 0, this is for tp less than 0. We're actually going to talk about the case where tp is negative. So this represents the putative, the coordinate singularity tp goes to 0 from negative infinity. Okay, so I'm going to claim that this is dual. This region of ADS space should be dual to Super Yang Mills on R times H3. And now I'm going to do one more thing, which is to orbifold this theory to mod out H3 by some infinite discrete group to render the hyperbolic space compact. When I do that orbifolding, I replace the Super Yang Mills on this. This is actually on nil space, minus dt p squared plus dp squared d sigma squared. If I do the orbifold, it's still locally in ds, but now this H3 is replaced by a compact hyperbolic space. This becomes an honest about singularity, and Gauge theory also lives on the singular space. So I orbifold taking H3 goes to sigma, which is H3 mod gamma. Now TP goes to 0, the singular in the ball and in the boundary. And now this is the kind of Big Bang singularity that is very similar to the other kinds of Big Bang singularities in ADS that various people look like. It stretches all the way out to the horizon. And when I first started thinking about this, because I didn't know the relationship of these hyperbolic ADS black holes, I got very worried because it's not clear that this corresponds to some, that this duality really comes from any kind of decoupling limit. But it happens in this case that there exist static coordinates. So I might have worried about this. Is this a good duality at all? Is this a good way to study these singularities? But it does happen that there are static coordinates, and so if I perform the following coordinate transformation, then I just get the R, the metric in RT is the M equals 0 hyperbolic ADS black hole with the form of the metric that I showed earlier. So strictly speaking, in this case, I have this Penrose diagram here. This region is covered by RP and TP, whereas for the point of view of a and is dual to Super Yang Mills on minus on the cosmological metric, whereas an external observer will most easily just which lives on the static space time R times sigma will see this static block. So I have two different ways of looking at the field theory. One is the QFT on what I will call, I'll draw as a cone, is dual, sees inside the black hole. whereas QFT, where this base is just sigma, QFT on this, what I might call a static cylinder, where this base is sigma, sees, describes the Schwarzschild observer. Outside the black hole system. So there seems to be a natural way to describe the infalling observer, which is to study quantum field theory on this.
Sorry, I'm a little bit confused. For example, we know when we go from one Carré patch to global ABS,
yeah.
it's also change of coordinates, right?
Yeah.
But it's change of coordinates similar to the ones that you are saying, in which the new time depends on the radial variables. In other words, you're changing what you mean by a Hamiltonian.
Yeah, it's actually we can talk. I agree with that, and I'll talk more about the coordinate transformations now. The global to local ADS is actually different, and so shall that conversation while I talk about those transformations.
No, but my question is, you are saying that that's the same theory, and I would say it's different theories.
No, they're not different theories. Let me go through this and then ask the question again, because it's a very tempting analogy, but I think it's not a correct analogy. Okay, so this is just, in the end of the day, this is just this M equals zero black hole is just a higher dimensional analog of the VGZ black hole. If I look at Gates theory on the collapsing cone, classically the solutions, say for a single probe or a shell, will look like phi zero plus phi 2 over t squared. This is the image of rp equals constant in Poincaré coordinates, and is in fact an exact solution even of the DBI action. I can look at the DBI action for a D3 grain probe, and S is going to be proportional to dtp times minus RPQ squared, and then there's going to be a plus fourth. This is actually an exact solution even of this DBI action. But when you look at this, the horizon is at RPTP is equal to L squared. And nothing special goes on at the horizon in this theory. There's no effective action, like an expanded small fluctuations, nothing bad goes on. So it looks like in this DBI action, that's a perfectly good way from the point of view of the Gates theory applying to the horizon. I reach it in finite time and everything. The fluctuations get large as TP goes to zero, because I can think of TP as an effective inverse H bar, given the way that it appears in the Lagrangian. So inverse H bar is getting large, the effective H bar is getting large as TP goes to zero. So things break down at the singularity instead. Finally, if I look at constant solutions for phi equals phi naught, the MW is constant, but MW over MKK is going to zero at the singular as TP goes to zero minus, because the volume of the compact space is getting smaller and smaller. So the same dimensional ratio is going to zero here, it's associated with the singularity. Okay. So that's the story I seem to have on the. I have quantum field theory on these two different spacetimes. One seems to look inside the horizon, the other doesn't. So let's talk about the relationship between these two quantum field theories and how they go between them. Now, you might have thought, at least we thought for a while, that this cylinder in this cone can actually be. You can make a transformation between this space-time and that space-time, redefinition of the time direction plus a conformal transformation takes one to the other. And so you might have thought that the two Yang-Mills theories, certainly the two Yang-Mills theories on one and Yang-Mills theory on the other should just be related by a conformal transformation. So let me talk about formal transformation. If I write T twiddle is minus L log T P over L, then ds squared, which is minus dtp squared plus dp squared d sigma squared, is equal to tp squared over L squared times minus dt twiddle squared plus d sigma squared. So this symbol redefinition of T gives you something which is conformally this shows that this collapsing cone is conformally equivalent to the static cylinder, and then I can just do a conformal transformation in the fields. So if I just let ds squared go to ds twiddle squared, and phi twiddle is equal to tp phi over L, or r twiddle is equal to minus tp RP over L, which, by the way, is the transformation of the radial coordinates from Poincaré to static coordinates. This takes super-Yang-Mills on the cylinder to super-Yang-Mills on the cone. So we say, okay, in this particular case, I can get inside the horizon simply by doing a coordinate transformation. But in fact, this would be very surprising, because if I think of this as a space-time coordinate transformation, it doesn't really change the time slicing at all. In particular, the equal time slices will look the same. And in fact, if I look at the metric in T twiddle and R in space-time, if I treat this as a space-time coordinate transformation, then I get the following metric, ds squared is equal to minus r twiddle squared over l squared minus 1 dt twiddle squared plus r twiddle squared d sigma squared plus l squared over r twiddle squared d r twiddle squared plus 2l over r twiddle dt dr twiddle. This describes Eddington-Finkelstein-like coordinates, which also see inside the horizon. So if I start with the Poincaré slicing, if I start with this the gauge theory on this collapsing cone, and I look at the corresponding bulk space-time, the equal time slices extend well into the horizon, and they do if I do this change of variables, because I haven't changed the time slicing here.
So the point is that for any finite RP, this TNTT level is then.
Yeah, that's right. And you know this because if you looked at the actual coordinate transformation I did to go to static coordinates here, this here has a non-trivial relation between T and R. And if I think of R as a scalar field, this is a horrible transformation. It's mixing up the time direction with the field directions. Which sounds like a very weird thing to do in the field. So in particular, the upshot is that this transformation doesn't map the DBI action, this DBI action, to the DBI action in Schwarzschild coordinates, which I wrote down earlier. You can show that explicitly.
But in your discussion so far, you talked about a mapping from one space to the other, but you actually wanted to study on the cylinder a very specific thing, namely a thermal bath.
Yes. So you have to know what.
Tell me what that is.
Right. It turns out that essentially there's a natural vacuum in the cone which you can inherit by the overfolding from the Minkowski vacuum in flat space. So it's one which in the far past has no particle production. in the past, and it's that that maps to the thermal state on the cylinder.
Okay.
So there is a particular, you're right, there's a particular state you have. You should be able to look at the other black holes with different masses and understand what they mean in terms of the current. I'm not saying that the two Yang Wells theories, by the way, are not related by conformal transformation, so let's talk about that. I am saying in some sense that
why don't we finish the story?
Yeah. I actually shouldn't have erased this. So let's talk about these coordinate transformations. So by itself, if you remember, I had R is equal to RP TP over L, and T is L over 2. Here, R and T are the coordinates in the static coordinates in space-time, and in the bulk, they were quite complicated. In particular, at finite R, this goes as L over L log RP over L plus terms which are of order L squared over RP squared L over 4, sorry, L squared over RPT. So far from the horizon, this looks very much like the same coordinate transformation they did before, but near the horizon, the transformation between RP and RT and the transformation between RPTP and the tilted coordinates will start to look very different. And these seem to involve mixing the field direction RP with the time coordinate in the field theory, which is a good thing to do. So what I'm going to do is simply let TP depend on a new proper time variable tau in the field theory. So tau is now the time direction of the field theory. This adds a gauge invariance. I can fix TP equals tau and get back to the theory I already have, the direct one initial theory I already have. So here I'm just going to talk about the quantum mechanical theory of the Dubrin probe. That's the new thing. So let me just look at the quantum mechanical theory of the Dubrin probe and as a piece of the full Yang-Mills theory. And in the quantum mechanical theory of the Dubrin probe, I can do this. This has a gauge invariance I have to deal with that in the action, of course, through the usual Fourier-Poisson mechanism, but I can certainly fix that gauge and get back the original theory. So this, when I do that, the DBI action is just d tau TP dot TP cubed RP cubed over L cubed root G mu nu X dot P mu, these are just all plus the terms coming from the Ramon-Ramon four form. And when I write it down in this language, the action in this form, these coordinate transformations now just look like some complicated nonlinear field redefinitions. If I consider both TP and RP as fields, this is just some complicated field redefinition corresponding, and this complicated field redefinition takes me from maps between one set of coordinates and another set of coordinates, but this action is essentially manifestly this transforms covariantly into these conformal transformations. So when I do this, I will get an action of the same form but in the Schwarzschild coordinates. Yeah, that's right. If I consider the DBI as a, if I wrote down the DBI in a covariant as a coherently from the start, that's what would happen. But if I get the DBI from, as an effective action from the field theory, T is really field theory time. And so then I have to add the stage invariance to get the covariant version. But I can do that, at least at the level of quantum mechanics, because I know it's H equivalent to the DBI action I got from the field theory. And then I can do this field redefinition. So now I can write S DBI. If I do this coordinate transformation, now it looks like D tau T dot R cubed root G M M, sorry, G mu nu. Now I just X mu and X nu are the coordinates in the corresponding coordinates in the static frame. And now I can fix not TP equals tau, but T equals tau, and I get DT R cubed root alpha minus I alpha. I get the standard DBI action in Schwarzschild coordinates. So the difference between this and this is essentially is it comes down to a difference in the choice of gauge and the DBI action. There's a gauge transformation that goes on. Again, if we tried to do this just by sticking in this gauge, I would have had to do some horrible transformation mixing up the field directions and the time directions. In a reparameterization invariant theory, though, this kind of thing isn't actually totally unusual. In fact, we do this in inflation. You can choose one gauge where the inflaton fluctuates. There's another gauge you can choose where the inflaton stays constant, and you're just looking at fluctuations of the spatial slices. And the relation between them involves a reparameterization of time slices, which depends on the it's a completely standard thing to do in that context. Things will look different. There's a non-trivial relationship between the conjugate momenta, because we're defined RP and R. But on the other hand, there's a non-trivial relationship between the conjugate momenta. But it turns out if I look not at the relation between the Poincaré coordinates and the Schwarzschild coordinates, but these Eddington Finkelstein coordinates and Schwarzschild coordinates, which look the same out of infinity, the Hamiltonian isn't any different. So you might have thought that to see inside the horizon, describe infalling observers, you need a different Hamiltonian. That appears not to be true. In fact, the Hamiltonian for Eddington-Finkelstein coordinates and for the Schwarzschild coordinates are the same. It's just the variables are very different. The conjugate momentum are very different. But the Hamiltonian isn't any different, essentially, because the time slicing out of infinity looks the same. That's the difference between the when I go from Poincaré global coordinates to standard ABS, you really are changing the time slicing out of infinity. So that's okay, I'm running way over time. The only other thing I'll mention is that so far I've just talked about the action of a single D3 ring probe. So I haven't talked yet about the full dynamic, the UN dynamics, and what the gauge transformation would look like from full UN dynamics. So I will just finish by saying something in words. It is absolutely true that, I mean, you might have said, well, this clearly comes from going out on the Coulomb branch integrating up the W bosons. You would have expected that it's the same for the DBI action of these Poincaré coordinates. And so why aren't the DBI actions mapping into each other under conformal transformation? Because certainly the underlying Yang-Mills theory does. Now, a similar story happened in the early days of ABS-CFT. If you look at the action of special conformal transformations, their invariants, special conformal transformations are symmetries of the Yang-Mills action, but the naive special conformal transformations are not symmetries of the DBI action. To get a symmetry of the DBI action, delta x goes as delta x. Delta x is delta x, the usual special conformal transformation, plus a term which goes inversely with the scalar field. This is an action of the special. This sort of pulls back from the isometries of the bulk ABS. And it's this modified field-dependent special conformal transformation, which is the symmetry of the full DBI action. Since the DBI action comes from the Yang-Mills by integrating out W bosons, you might ask what happens. Javitki and Yudea later pointed out that this simple special conformal, whenever I compute the effect of action, I have to fix gauge. I have to fix to some background field gauge. And background field gauge isn't invariant under this naive special conformal transformation. And the combination of the gauge transformation, if you to fix that, plus the special conformal transformation, amounts to this transformation on the full effect of action. The same thing happens here. The conformal transformation we talk about is not an invariant. The background field gauge is an invariant under that conformal transformation. So my guess is that if I look at the full Yang-Mills theory to go between one frame and the other, I have to do not just the conformal transformation, but a change of gauge as well. So somehow this the space-time coordinate transformation comes from gauge transformation in the underlying quantum field theory. It's not a priori obvious that these two symmetries should be related, but our guess is that they are in this point. Anyway, I've gone way over time, so I will stop here. Thanks for your patience.